Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So I'm actually giving you 4 weeks in two. So actually, today is the last day. I'm going to see if I know how to turn this blank. Don't worry about it. So it's good to be back with you. And we had a very, very rich conversation last week. Looking forward to sort of building on that a little bit, taking it in a couple of new directions. Last week, you'll recall, we talked about storytelling, about our narratives, and specifically focused on the narrative, the story of ancient Israel, the captivity in Egypt, and the Exodus. Tied that to a similar parallel story of African-American journey from slavery to social mobility, and talked about the importance of story. We ended with a question from, and what is your name?
Carol.
Carol. Which really is the definitive question to kind of set us up for today. Her question essentially was, can we really move toward reconciliation when we are made aware of our stories, especially when those stories are stories of pain and injury and trauma? Can we get to reconciliation when we're being alert to story? I think that really is the question that kind of brings us to today. So I want to do a few things as we think about this theme of healing and re-membering. Remembering in the sense of the members of our body, pulling ourselves back together into some sort of a collective whole. I want to start with a couple of scripture passages that really move us in some important ways into reflections about acknowledging each other's story. And then look at a couple of contemporary examples of how entire nations have tried to wrestle with their own histories of trauma and then movement toward something like remembering, reconstituting, recollecting themselves, or in some ways maybe even forming themselves into a collective whole for the first time. And then hopefully end on a note of modeling for the future. So that's where we're going to go. Let me start. We don't have a lot of time, and I don't want to spend all the time with me talking so we can get to some real exchange here. But let's start with those scripture passages, those scriptural accounts of acknowledgement of the other, the person that is different from yourself. The first both of these passages you'll be quite familiar with, but we want to sort of pull a few things from those passages. The first one being John 4, the account where Jesus encounters a Samaritan woman at the well. Very familiar story. But let's just refresh our memories on that passage, starting with verse 4, John chapter 4, verse 4. I'm reading from the New International Version. I'll read about 12 or 13 verses of this quickly. Now he, meaning Jesus, had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me to drink?" His disciples had gone into town to buy food. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." "Sir," the woman said, "you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water?" Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his livestock? Jesus answered, Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The woman said to him, Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water. He told her, Go, call your husband and come back. I have no husband, she replied. Jesus said to her, You are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true. Sir, the woman said, I can see that you are a prophet. And then jumping down to verse 28. Then leaving her water jar, the woman went back to the town and said to the people, Come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Could this be the Messiah? They came out of the town and made their way toward him. I want to point out three things about this passage that I think are quite important to our discussion. First of all, Jesus begins his interaction with this woman, the Samaritan woman, a woman representing a group of people within that context that were considered socially marginal, socially other than the Jews, and the fact that she was a woman in a male-centric culture. So in two respects, this Samaritan woman was an outsider, and she encounters Jesus the Jew at this sort of monument to the Jewish story, this well of Jacob. Well dug by one of the great fathers of the Jewish people, Jacob. And Jesus begins in an act of relationality. An act of relationality and hospitality. So in ancient cultures, and even still in many of our contemporary cultures, we manage to hang on to some aspects of this. Sharing a drink together, sharing a meal together is a relational act. It's an act of hospitality. Someone comes into your house, certainly as my wife and I, and let me please introduce my wife, Angelique, who's with me today. She's actually not with me all the time because she works in Washington, D.C. at Bread for the World. So she's with us this weekend. Glad to have her here. But as we have traveled often throughout Africa, very traditional context, go into a village. You go into a village home. You sit down. I mean, the first thing, you're invited in. They may not even know you. You're invited in. You're seated. And the very first act will be, after sort of greeting you and maybe asking about your family, the very first act will be to offer you a cup of cold water. That is an act of hospitality. So Jesus begins this interaction, this exchange, this engagement between Jesus and this outsider woman, centers around a relational act, an act of hospitality. Would you offer me, can you offer me a drink? She's there drawing water. He actually, in this instance, is a stranger. She knows the well. She knows it very, very, very well. He's the stranger. He comes in, sits down at the well, and his request is, can you show me hospitality? Can we enter into a relational act together here? She's shocked. She's shocked because, yes, this is a symbolically powerful act. Here is a Jewish man, even though a stranger, a Jewish man asking to enter into a relational act with me. An act of hospitality, an act of acknowledgement, right? So there's an acknowledgement at that level that we can enter into some sort of relational situation together. Secondly, I mean, if that wasn't powerful enough, right, and that was powerful, if you understand the context. But if that wasn't powerful enough, then the second thing that Jesus does is enter into her story. Okay, he enters into her narrative. He acknowledges her humanity in a way by virtue of outlining her story. Now, that was a miraculous act, obviously. I mean, we couldn't just walk up to a stranger and know everything about the stranger. Jesus had the ability to do that. But that's not the important point here. The important point is here that he chose to lift up her story. Now, it was in kind of a roundabout, interesting way. I mean, he says, go get your husband. She says, well, you know, I don't have a husband. Well, yeah, in fact, you've had five before. The one you're with now is not your husband. But it wasn't necessarily a statement of judgment. It was a statement of acknowledging who this woman is. So just as Jesus, when the woman was caught in adultery, and the Jewish leaders said, this woman was caught in the very act, she needs to be stoned. Jesus said, okay, well, if whoever has not sinned, you cast the first stone. I'm not interested in judging this woman. So Jesus enters into the story of that woman, not in a judgmental way, but simply, okay, I acknowledge this is what happened. Okay. But I'm not concerned with judging the woman. I'm simply entering into the story. So Jesus with the Samaritan woman, he wasn't saying, you know, here you are you've had five husbands, you're living with a man now, not your husband. I can't really be associated with you. No. That's the very woman. Jesus had foreknowledge of her story, but Jesus says, give me some water to drink. Let's enter into a relational act together, an act of hospitality. I come alongside you. I acknowledge you. I embrace you and your story. Here, I know your story. Okay, I know your story. So that's powerful. Acknowledgement of her as a person, an outsider, acknowledgement of her story. Okay, and so the woman's overwhelmed. She knows something big is happening here. This is unusual that this level of acknowledgement could happen between persons on opposite sides of kind of a social boundary. This level of acknowledgement is happening. And so it excites her to the extent that she runs back and she tells not only the person that she's living with, who's not her husband, but many people, come and see a man who told me everything I ever did. That was her words. Come and see a man who acknowledged my story. A man who entered deeply into my story. This is wonderful. Come and meet this man from the other side of the boundary who entered into my story. That was so powerful for her. That was so powerful. Okay. That's one scripture. Let's go to the second scripture, which gives us a kind of a different spin. Another familiar passage. Luke 10, verses 25 through 37, the story of the Good Samaritan. Okay, so here we have Samaritans in both instances. We have this social outsider group in both instances. The woman being acknowledged in her outsiderness by Jesus. And then we get this account where the Samaritan is the principal actor in this particular story. Here we go, verse 25. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus, meaning a Jewish expert. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? What is written in the law? Jesus replied, how do you read it? The man answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself. You have answered correctly, Jesus said. Do this and you will live. But the man wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, and who is my neighbor? In reply, Jesus said, a story. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. Levites, that's sort of even in a higher class of religious leadership. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. "Look after him," he said, "and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have." Jesus says, "Which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers?" The expert in the law replied, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise." Now, first we get 2 accounts of failure to acknowledge the other. Now, this is a Jewish man who's fallen amongst thieves, was beaten, robbed, stripped, left by the road to die. Jewish priest walks by, does not acknowledge the situation, does not acknowledge what has happened, does not acknowledge this person laying by the road. The Levite, the Levitical track of Jewish folks, the priestly, high priestly track, does the same thing. Ignores the person on the side of the road, crosses to the other side of the road so as not to even be proximate to the person, as did the priest. Then the social outsider comes along, the other. The Samaritan man comes, sees the man. Emphasis here on see. I see you. I see what has happened here. I acknowledge something bad has happened here. Okay? The acknowledgement aspect, that's the most important part. And we're going to talk about, I want to move into to more about this acknowledgement aspect. But let me just give you 2 other points about this one that will be sort of toward the end of our discussion today. Not only did the man acknowledge, not just acknowledge that there's a guy on the side of the road, to acknowledge the situation means to admit there's injury that has happened here. There's harm that's been done. This man is not just laying there happenstance. Harm has been done. Something wrong has happened here. I acknowledge something wrong has befallen this man. The acknowledgement is an acknowledgement of injury. 2 other things the man does. The first thing he does is stop the bleeding. He responds to the injury. He acknowledges it, then he responds. He grabs the man. He tries to nurse the man to the point to put him on the donkey and then take him to an inn where he can be more systematically addressed in terms of his injuries. And then the third thing, after the initial acknowledgement, the initial response to stopping the bleeding, right, the immediate response to the problem, he looks toward a longer-term restoration of what has happened to this man. He says to the innkeeper, "Look, here's some money. See if this covers what needs to be done here. If it doesn't, when I come back from where I need to go right now, I'll reimburse you for whatever additional expenses may have been involved in repairing the situation." So from acknowledgement to an immediate response to long-term repair. Okay, we'll come back to those last 2 later. But the acknowledgement part, Now, my wife and I spent a lot of time, like I said, on the African continent. South Africa, I've been in South Africa almost every year since 1983. First went to 1983 during the heart of the apartheid years. 7 short years after the massacre that took place of the students in Soweto in 1976, students, high school students, middle school students, out in the streets of Soweto, the township Soweto, black township, protesting the imposition of Afrikaans as the language in which they would have to be instructed in their schools. Now, they're not Afrikaans speakers. That was the language of the Afrikaner ruling class. These were English speakers. These were the students, that is, were English speakers. They spoke many traditional languages, Sotho, Tswana, Zulu, Xhosa, many languages, but not Afrikaans. So now, already in an inferior situation in school in terms of the resources that were expended for anything related to the black community, now they're being said, okay, all of your instruction is going to take place in Afrikaans. Well, that was the final straw for those students. They got out in the streets protesting. Close to 1,000 were gunned down, killed by the security forces. So my first arrival in South Africa was in Soweto, 1983, a few short years after this. Anyway, very much had an opportunity to kind of peek in at the pain of this nation. 83 again, and 85, 86, just about every year going up to the transition that takes place in 1994. Miraculous transition, 1994. Nelson Mandela is released from prison a couple of years prior to that after having spent almost 30 years in prison for his activism to try to bring about democracy and equality within the context. 94, he's elected president, major transition in the country, at least in terms of the political leadership and many other areas of the country. But this, now apartheid had been in place in South Africa, the formal policies of apartheid, meaning separate racial development, where whites basically configured a situation where all the advantages and benefits and resources basically accrued to them, and the remainder was left to the majority population. Black South Africans made up about 80% of the population, but they had very few of the resources, including the land resources at that point. So 1947 or 48, I can't remember, right in that area was when the apartheid policies officially came into play. You had hundreds of years of quasi-apartheid prior to that. So this is a long history of struggle for black South Africans and so-called colored and even Asian South Africans. Long history of struggle, of inequality, of oppression. You get the transition in 94. Is everything now addressed? Is everything now healed? Is everything back to normal? No. You have a major political transition, but you've still got literally centuries of injury and harm that have to be addressed. Now, what the South African government did, the new South African government, Mandela's government, was to implement what was called a truth and reconciliation process. Archbishop Desmond Tutu was appointed by President Mandela to oversee, to head up this truth and reconciliation process. The way it worked was that anyone who had committed harm against someone else within the context of apartheid-era politics. Now, you know, not just criminality of other descriptions, but any political crimes. If you come before the commission, and there was an appointed commission, Archbishop Tutu headed it up, but there were distinguished people who impaneled this commission of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. You come before the commission, you fully confess to your crime, and if you do so, then you're granted basically pardon. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa did not work in a way that said when and if you confess your crimes, that then you would have to somehow account for that through being incarcerated or through restoring what you may have taken away from someone else. That was not a part of the South African Truth and Reconciliation process. Just simply, if you confess truthfully and fully, then that's off the table. Now, the thought was that the argument was in the South African case that if the government had insisted on restitution, on incarceration, that the process just wouldn't have happened at all, or that it would have. It would have just fanned the flames of conflict because it was a powder keg in South Africa in 1994. People were angry, very angry, on both sides. Blacks were still angry about centuries of injury and harm, and whites were angry that their country was now being given away, they felt, to the black community. That was their perspective, right? So there was anger, and the volatility was in the air. So that was the approach the South African government took. Now the problem is, for a lot of black South Africans who had encountered injury, they felt like that really was not a way to acknowledge what they had gone through. Not only did it not fully acknowledge it, but it did nothing to try to repair the situation. Nothing. That was their feeling. But that's what they did. That's what they felt, at least that's what the government felt, was the best they could do at that point. So, with that in mind, now, let me say one other thing. Rwanda, and then I'm going to show you some figures from both places. Rwanda, you know Rwanda, 1994. A massacre occurs in Rwanda. Over a million people are killed within a very short period of time in an internal conflict. I mean, a short period of time, I'm talking just 2 or 3 months. It was genocide, very short-term genocide, ethnic-related conflict that had been brewing for a long, long time, and then it just explodes. And this was the result. Now, Rwanda also had a tribunal process, an even more formal dimension of a truth and reconciliation process. It was kind of an international tribunal process where people were going to be, they didn't say come before us and confess and you get off, not at all. Basically, the tribunal process identified perpetrators, brought them before the tribunal, charged them, incarcerated them, and that was the process. Now, the problem is that tribunal process was very, very costly, very unwieldy, because it was a big thing, and they ended up actually processing only a handful of people. I mean, very, very few people came before the tribunal. It was just too unwieldy a process. So what happens in the meantime is that local communities in Rwanda formed what was called the Wakaka courts. These were like local community courts, where the elders in the community presided over these cases. So people could either come voluntarily before the Wakaka court, or they could be charged by someone with a crime and then brought before the Wakaka court, where the elders would listen to the evidence, they would make a ruling, If a person was convicted of perpetrating some sort of an injustice or a crime, they had to account for it. They had to account for it either through being incarcerated, they had the power of incarceration, sometimes it was an either or you provide restitution if you took someone's land, you took someone's home. Because this was going on, as people were being massacred, then their possessions, their property were being confiscated by the people who may have been the perpetrators. So there was accounting that took place in this Wakaka court. Thousands and thousands of people were processed by these local community courts. And you'll see that these two processes led to very different results. Here we go. I think I know how to do this here. No? Let's see. Let me see if this... Oh, okay. No, let's see what happened. Which one? Oh, did you do that manually? You did it manually. Okay, because this one's not moving it at all. Okay, so if you wouldn't mind helping me. So, South Africa, this might be a little hard to see. It's even hard for me to see here, so I'm sorry about that. But there are various measurements, various indicators of reconciliation. Both South Africa and Rwanda, over the past 10 years or so, have executed what they called a reconciliation barometer. It's a national survey of, representative group of South Africans on the one hand or Rwandans on the other hand. They're asked many questions that are indicators of how well the reconciliation process is moving along, how well a kind of national unity, a kind of community bridge building, how well those kinds of things are happening, confidence in the government, confidence in the institutions of the society, confidence in and interactions between various groups within the societies, ethnic groups, racial groups, economic class groups, and so forth. Very important kind of thing, right? I mean, a very important measurement tool. So anyway, here's some of the data from the South African Reconciliation Barometer. Now, this is asking about desirability and possibility of creating one united South Africa. Okay, and what we've got here is kind of a year-by-year reporting of this. So the blue line presents desirable to create one united South African nation. The red line, possible to create one united South African nation. Those figures don't look too bad. So from 2003, you had about 70% who indicated favorably on this particular question, desirable and possible to create one united South Africa. But you see that over that 10-year period, that number has declined. For both of those, desirable and possible. It's declined for both of those. Here the respondents were asked, what is it that gives you your primary kind of sense of identity, right? How are you defining yourself from an identity standpoint? Language is the blue line, ethnicity the red line, race, the yellow line, and South African nationality, the green line. Well, you can see that in South Africa, the strongest identification in terms of group identification is by language. Secondly, by race. Thirdly, by ethnicity, and only at the tail end is South African nationality, right? So the fact that we're all South Africans. You can see that these numbers are trending, well, at least as it relates to language still is a very strong source of identification. The others are kind of trending a little bit downward, including, though, the South African nationality. Okay, interracial mistrust. How strong is the level of mistrust across racial groups? So the basic question is, people of other races are untrustworthy. How many people feel that way? Well, about 40% in 2003 felt that way. It stayed pretty much close to that, dipped under 30% here more recently. Not a very strong indicator of trustworthiness. Interracial mistrust by race. So as you break out that particular question by racial groups, which racial groups seem to have more trust in other racial groups, or less trust, as the case may be? So black South Africans score higher in terms of having a feeling of trust toward other racial groups. White South Africans, which are the blue line, are scoring, you know, not as high by any stretch. Asian and colored are even lower on that indicator than are white South Africans. Not a strong, so you're looking at, what, 30, 40%, 20% range. We're not talking about real high numbers of those, any of those groups that feel a strong sense of trustworthiness across these barriers. Now, you would think, you would hope, and it certainly has been stated in a sort of aspirational way, well, as the apartheid era generation dies off and the post-apartheid generations become more the majority, we'll see a lot of difference in what's happening in South Africa. Unfortunately, that does not appear to be the case. So in 2003, still around 40% of South African youth indicated high levels of mistrust, right? So it is declining. It is declining to under 30%. So this is mistrust by age. So there is decline there. There is some improvement on that particular indicator. Desire for interracial interaction. So desire for more interracial talk is the blue line. That number is declining over this 10-year period. And it's only been about 30% or so at its height. Desire to learn more about the customs of other races, the red line. That's been over 50%, but has declined over the last 10 years to under 40%. Desire for more interracial talk by race. Okay, that's pretty much kind of what we saw before. Although you see here that, in other words, to be in dialogue with one another, to have conversations, to communicate with one another, the numbers aren't really very encouraging. Now, the colored population in 2003 had very high numbers on that, close to 70%. That has declined precipitously to around 20% in 10 years that say that they have a desire to really be in conversation with people across races. The white population has been at the bottom on that particular indicator for that 10-year period. Now only about 10% of the white population in South Africa saying, yes, I have a desire to be in conversation, to be in dialogue with people across race lines. Approval of racial integration. Colored population, this is different. So blue line is approve of having people of other races a neighbor. The red line, approving of marrying people from another race. The orange line, approve of going to school with people from another race. The green line, approval of working with people from another race. Those numbers are not bad. I mean, so 70% say, yeah, it's okay to go to school, or close to 70 in 2003, dropped down to 60% by 2013. The marriage line is the lowest of those, under 50% basically. How many South Africans agree that apartheid was a crime against humanity? An important point here. So this acknowledgement, right? Acknowledgement of the other. Acknowledgement of injury. Acknowledgement that something bad has happened here. Well, 86% agreed in 2003. 76% agreed in 2013. A decline in the proportion of South Africans who acknowledge that something bad happened here. And when you break that down by race, these numbers are particularly troubling for South Africa. While the majority, the vast majority of blacks, 80%, 81% really say yes, apartheid was a crime against humanity, 52, 53% of the white population say the same thing. It's a very troubling situation, and you feel it when you're in South Africa. You feel the very different kind of view of the history and of the current situation as you move from white to black in South Africa to this day. Okay, so apartheid wrongly oppressed the majority of South Africans. Okay, and this is by racial group. Who's acknowledging that apartheid oppressed the majority of South Africans? The black population, 85% in 2012, a dip from 2012 to 2013 to under 80% for some reason. But the numbers are declining. So, and the white population, 70% say in 2012, which is good, that apartheid did wrongly oppress the majority. Don't want to call it a crime against humanity, but they will say wrongly oppressed the majority of South Africans. But that number declined in 1 year from 70 to 50%. So some things are moving in the wrong direction in South Africa, for sure. Apartheid resulted in poverty of many black South Africans. 80% of blacks said so, and still around 80% of the black population say that is correct. 50% in 2012 down to close to 30% in 2013 of the white population say that apartheid resulted in poverty for many black South Africans. Reconciliation is impossible if those disadvantaged by apartheid are still poor. Okay? Is reconciliation possible without addressing the poverty of the majority of the black population? That's really the question on the table. So the black population, about 50%, 55% to 60% say reconciliation is impossible without addressing that. The Asian population is around the same place. You see the white population from 2011 down to 2013 has declined from just over 40% to just under 30%, who feel that it's necessary for the government to address, and not just the government, but the society to address issues of economic inequality if reconciliation is going to have a chance to take place. Now we move to Rwanda. And I just have a couple of short slides on here. We don't have a lot of time to go through it. But just look at the averages on these. So when Rwandans were asked, how important is understanding the past and envisioning the future? 92%. Are saying, yes, it's important that we acknowledge that. So this issue about how are you identifying yourself? What is the basis of your social identity? 96% are saying national identity is how I primarily identify myself. Now, this is 2012, 2013. So 20 years after the genocide, but even 20 years after the genocide, where you had that level of trauma that took place within the society, a short 20 years later, you've got people saying, 95%, 96% of the people saying, you know what? What I identify with most strongly is my Rwandan citizenship. You've got 97% who say they're proud of their shared identity. Commitment to national identity, 98%. Trust in the leaders, 96%. Confidence in all these different institutions, very, very high. Sense of security and well-being, 90% or more. Very secure in various aspects of their... So you get a little bit of this again. The social cohesion, from 2010 to 2015, social cohesion goes up from about 88% to 96%. Very different numbers than what we saw in South Africa. Very different numbers. So what accounts for that? Where in South Africa, the levels of social cohesion, the levels of identifying with groups across the boundaries of race, language, ethnicity, class, the levels of interaction The confidence in the possibilities for reconciliation, relatively low. I mean, most of those numbers were under 50% for all those categories. And when you break it out by race, blacks were more positive in their sense of where things could go or should go. Whites were far less positive. But here in Rwanda, extremely high numbers, over 95% for many of these same indicators. What accounts for the difference? Well, one of the things, and I use this in my more than one of my classes at Pittsburgh Seminary, and so what time do we end? Oh, okay, we don't have much time. Okay, very okay. So, first of all, one difference between these two contexts is the issue of race. South Africa is about race. Rwanda is not about race. Rwanda was about ethnicity. The power of race, this invented notion of race, it's an artificial construct, totally invented, has no meaning other than that we have invested in it over centuries of creating these false distinctions based upon skin color. But it has eventuated in very, very powerful divisions that have tracked precisely along race lines. Ethnicity, as powerful as ethnicity is as a potential point of division, it does not achieve the same level of divisiveness that race has achieved. So that's one issue that separates the Rwandan and the South African case. Secondly, the process of accounting for the past was different in those two instances. Rwanda had a process where not only was there some sort of symbolic acknowledgement that something, some injuries and harms had occurred, but these things were prosecuted. These things were litigated. These things, people had to account for the past. You acknowledge what happened. You acknowledge the injury. The man laying by the side of the road. You acknowledge the man is there. He's been harmed. He's been injured. He has to be responded to based upon the harm and the injury. It's not enough just to say, I acknowledge there's a man laying by the side of the road who's been injured, and then keep walking. Acknowledgement means that you deal with the situation that has resulted in where this person is. And then you begin those processes of repair and of restoration. That's what happened in Rwanda, did not happen in South Africa. Okay, so there's that. Let me just rush on here so that we have at least some opportunity for some exchange here. Okay, we've not done that in the United States. We've not even done what South Africa did. We've just simply said, let's just move on. Let's just move on from slavery. Let's just move on from segregation. We get irritated when the issues are brought up. We don't want to, we're certainly not trying to say, to acknowledge the injury. That there have been no official apologies for slavery in the United States. No official apologies. The reason being, now Clinton tried to do it, and Obama tried to do it, but the problem is that if you actually apologize officially, it becomes actionable at that point. You've admitted that you did something wrong, and then the lawsuits can pour in. So they're like, we won't apologize. We'll admit that something went wrong. That's about where we've gone with that at the presidential level. It's about as far as we've gone with it. Canada, gone way beyond that. Australia, way beyond that. Okay? South Africa, Rwanda, way beyond that. The United States, we've not done that. We don't even like to talk about what happened. So part of it is that, well, we're concerned. Your name again?
Carol.
I thought it was Carol. We're concerned that by raising the issues, that it's just going to make things worse. We'll never get over it. We'll never get beyond it. Well, that's not what happened in Rwanda. By not acknowledging it in South Africa, they've not gotten over it. They've not been able to move on. Nor have we here in the United States. Because we've not really said, okay, let's deal with this thing. Let's acknowledge that somebody was injured. They're laying at the side of the road, and let's take some steps to really say we're going to systematically engage in repair and restoration based upon injury. Now, I'm not just talking about some kind of reparation strategy here. That's not the only way that plays out. Acknowledgement can take a lot of different kind of directions, but we've not done it. Not at an official level, not at high levels. My alma mater, Yale University, right now is kind of struggling with how to begin to acknowledge the fact that they had some of their buildings named after former slave owners, Calhoun Hall. And they had to wrestle with that, and they finally got around to saying, well, I think we probably do need to take his name off that building. Georgetown, Emory University, both dealing with their slave past and struggling with acknowledging it and trying to move forward with it. Meanwhile, the students in all those institutions are saying, hey, isn't it about time that we do something here to acknowledge, at least by no longer celebrating, right, that harmful past, by having buildings and so forth named after slave owners? So we're struggling to really address these issues. End on a positive note here. Churches haven't done a real great job on that either. Not at all. Now, a lot of the denominations have actually come out with some apologies on race. So a lot of the mainline denominations have issued some apologies. That's a good thing. Some have engaged in some other kinds of very specific steps. The Pittsburgh Presbytery, right? There's a whole initiative right now around black males. Very, very important initiative. The Presbytery is allocating $5 million toward trying to address repair issues in the face of mass incarceration of black males and in the face of all the kinds of things that have been happening that have disadvantaged these communities. That's a good step. Christian Community Development Association is an organization that my wife and I have had a lot of interaction with, one of the largest gatherings of evangelical Christians in the country. Evangelical Christians. And they meet annually. 4,000 or 5,000 people come together for all kinds of dialogue, discourse, and interaction, particularly around issues of community economic development, faith-based community economic development, urban community building strategies, urban ministry strategies. That's their forte. John Perkins, if any of you have ever heard of John Perkins, African-American minister from Civil Rights Movement, evangelical minister, is the founder of that organization, along with a guy named Wayne Gordon, white guy who's a former coach, who is the pastor of big church in Chicago. I forget the name of it. Willow? Not. Yeah, I can't remember the name of it. Big church. Anyway, it's an interracial, very, very interracial group of folks, thousands and thousands of folks. Not only white and black, but Latino, Asian. It is one of the most diverse big gatherings of Christians that we see on an annual basis. And they're focusing on three primary thematic issues right now as an organization. Problems with the public schools, addressing that issue. Mass incarceration, addressing that issue. And poverty. These are tough issues. These are divisive issues. But an evangelical interracial group has said, we're not going to just love in word. We're going to love in deed. We're going to take on these tough issues together. Although historically, as evangelicals, we've not been good in addressing these issues, But this body of Christians is going to take on these issues. And we're going to do it systematically. We're going to do it throughout the year. Our conferences are going to be framed around this on an annual basis. We're going to really throw the gauntlet down on these issues as this body of evangelical Christians. So those are good things. Those are good steps. There are lots of possibilities. Starts with acknowledgement of our story, acknowledgement of the injury, and then taking the necessary steps to be responsive in concrete ways to what has happened. Let me stop there and see if we have a couple of minutes for some questions or comments. We got about 5 minutes or, okay, or less? Less, okay. Okay. Exactly. Yeah, a couple quick responses on that. Big difference between Emory and Georgetown on that. Georgetown, what Georgetown did is very, very important. Very important. I was teaching at Emory a few years ago as a visiting professor. One of my students, at the time I was there, Emory University announced a kind of process for students to submit suggestions about how Emory University as an institution might respond to its slavery past. And my student, an African-American woman, submitted exactly a proposal along the lines of what Georgetown did. You need to provide, she didn't say free schooling, she said significantly more financial assistance for African-American students to come to Emory. Well, she did not win that competition. What won was really what kind of was floating from the outset, which was, we'll build a statue. That's what happened at Emory. Georgetown did something very big. Now, the issue of compensation is a very difficult one because it's hard to figure out, well, where does the compensation go? The injuries occurred a long time ago, and so you've got a real problem around that. I don't know how you sort that one out. I think what they did was a very practical step, which is, first of all, to say, in principle, or to say, in fact, we will make financial assistance, in fact, scholarship, available to descendants of slaves. Now, then the process of seeking out, because, I mean, that's pretty much the whole African-American community. I mean, most African-Americans are descendants of slaves. So, I mean, how you sort that out. But the fact that they did try to create some sort of a category of acknowledgement and a way of responding to the larger problem, I think, is a very important step. The reparations conversation is an important one, needs to happen, but needs to be approached in a very sensible way to figure out, well, if, you know, where restitution occurs, what's a sensible way to do that? Where does this money go? You know, what's supposed to happen here? I mean, That's a very difficult thing to answer. And my own sense is that if it ever occurs and moves in that direction, then clearly it has to be broadly pitched. I mean, it can't be individuals getting money or just arbitrary institutions getting money, but some kind of broad reconstruction, I mean, a Marshall Plan, right? A Marshall Plan, some big category that feeds a broader process of development. Okay, so Urban League has come up with something along the lines of a Marshall Plan for Black America.
Just a comment. The figures that you showed can't probably get at this aspect, but of the people in Rwanda and in
South Africa,
what percentage of them are really on deck with the idea of reconciliation and forgiveness as opposed to justice in terms of punishment? Say if 99% of the people really believe in a more tribal notion of punishing and justice in that sense, they're not going to be happy with reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
It may be that its favorability is going to decline in time. Same thing is true in America.
Yeah.
A large percentage of the people aren't interested in forgiveness and reconciliation, but more hard justice. It's going to be difficult to move towards something like reconciliation.
Yeah. Those two categories are distinct, can be divergent, but they can also be convergent. In Rwanda, they were convergent. So it was about justice and about reconciliation. The one could not really happen without the other in their mind. Here's what I mean by that. So for Rwandans, it was all about reconciliation. That was the end goal. That was the end goal, was reconciliation. And in Rwanda, from the very beginning, even as they're having these communal courts and the tribunal, from the very beginning, was that their whole point was, we can never move forward unless we forgive. We can never move forward unless we forgive. Now, forgiveness was not a cheap forgiveness. It wasn't just, it wasn't just, well, you don't have to acknowledge, you don't have to try to account for anything, we just forgive you. No, forgiveness was the end goal. It wasn't about carrying the grudge. It was about, let's forgive, let's move, let's get beyond this, but let's get beyond it in a responsible way.
Was the population going along with that?
That was the population. Those numbers, that's really what you're seeing. You're seeing like 90% plus of Rwandans who are basically saying, we want forgiveness to happen, we want reconciliation. That's not what's happening in South Africa. It's not what's happening here.
How do you account for that?
Yeah, again, I think, the process, I think for real reconciliation and forgiveness to happen, there has to be real acknowledgement of injury and harm and real steps to try to address it.
You have to have Samaritans.
Yeah, and not the priest and the Levite.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay, very good. Thank you.